Our first Q&A last month was with WHO's sound engineer, Bob Pridden. And today I'm delighted to have with me the man who tipped Bob off about that job that was going with the WHO back in 1966. He's a former chauffeur for erstwhile British patent exploding drummer Keith Moon, and for Mr. John Entwistle, the virtuoso ox. He is John Wolfe, known to all and sundry, and believe me, he is known to all and sundry, as Wiggy.
Including all the police forces around the country that we've been evading while we're in the...
We're not going to talk about that this morning. Good morning, John.
Carry on.
Right, let's go back to basics. Before you worked for the WHO, I read that you worked for the Walker Brothers.
Absolutely, that was my first big band. And between the Walker Brothers and the WHO, there were a number of other smaller ones entering that weren't so well known. The Cubas, you may have remembered. You would probably remember the Cubas.
I remember the Cubas, yeah.
The Cubas. And also Beryl Marsden and the Crew Cats.
I remember Beryl Marsden. I used to see her at the Capitol.
Beryl Marsden was a fantastic singer, and the Crew Cats were made up of Archie Leggett and Harry Casey and one other chap though I can't remember his name. Sorry about that. And I believe you know Howie quite well, Richard.
Howie Casey. Yes, indeed. Yeah.
All from the pool.
Mm.
And they were an exciting bunch to be around.
So how come you got to get a job with the WHO then?
It's not a long story, but I first of all met the WHO via Pete Townsend, who I helped with a bunch of people from the Gioconda coffee shop in Denmark Street.
I know the Gioconda very well. Yeah.
To start his car, so I mustered a lot of people out the Gioconda. Uh-huh. He had this huge American car. It was coming out of his publishers. I think it was Platt's in Denmark Street. And he said, could you give us a push, you know, for start? So I pushed him up Tottenham Court Road, boof, he put the thing, and it started. He didn't thank, because he didn't have time, just waved out the side of the thing, thanks a lot. And that was my first introduction to Pete. The second introduction was when Walker Brothers had a hit at Ready Steady Go, and the WHO were on the same bill, with Cathy McGowan and all the team. The roadie for the WHO then, I forget his name, had left the snare drum, or hadn't bought the snare drum for Keith. So he came over, and he was a very cheeky, ebullient chap. You know, he came over and said, would you mind if I borrowed Gary Walker's snare drum? So I said, no, that's all right, Keith. And then, of course, I realised that they were well known for smashing everything to pieces. And Gary came over, and he was a bit white. I said, look, he's just going to borrow it, because he's going on first. He's just borrowing your snare drum. He said, well, he won't break it, will he? I said, no, he's promised he wouldn't break it. So I've got my fingers up behind, crossed behind my back. And he didn't actually break it, but he played it rather hard. So we did have the Rockies, the holes across the dents. And that was the first time I'd ever changed a snare drum skin, actually, in my life, because I had to get another one. Because it would be
so this would have been early 1965.
Yeah, this is way back.
January, wasn't it? First time.
Because we all used to go down the clubs, and the Scottish St James was the famous one for going to after show. And I used to go down there with Beryl Mars and the Crew Cats. We used to play down there, and other bands. You know, it was one of those little bijou gigs that bands would do in those days. And so I became a bit of a face. The WHO used to come in. The Beatles used to come in. And I had my little corner where I'd sit if I was doing something. And then one day, Keith came up and he said, you loan me a drum thing down at Ready Steady Go, because he's had a good memory for that. He said, can you drive us to a gig tomorrow? Because we've just bought a new car, Bentley, and we have a chauffeur, but he's not a face. He was a bit older, you know. So he said, we don't like his long coat, and if you can, you know, you look after all these bands, you can give us to ride up. So that was really the start of it. We hit it off straight away. These were lunatics. I always got along with drummers. Sorry about that. So to the other bands that I was doing was with Viv Prince. of the Pretty Things. Mm. He was the first musician that I picked up, because I used to be a minicab driver. And my office was around the corner from Stratford Place, where the Stardust was, or Starlight was. And so I got on with drummers, because Viv's a lunatic.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to run him home to Loughborough a few times and get him out of fights at the Blue Boar. So, I kind of gravitate towards... And John was all very stalwart. He was also on the thing, because they didn't have drive licences. So it was Keith who approached. John was very laconic, as he is, and he grunted, that'll be great. We don't like him anyway, so you do it. And so started off like a very tempestuous, reasonably short time when you add it up now in terms of months and years. But because it was such a full life with these two characters, driving them and the laughs we had, and then the rest of the band and the mayhem, it was just like a real piece of my history, that I'd kind of... I wouldn't exchange for anything.
Mm.
Of course, that got me involved with The Who, and so it went on from driving Keith and John to seeing that there were shortages in the pay packet. Because I'd been picking up for the money for the Walker Brothers and all the other bands, and very often they were done on percentages of the gate. I noticed that they were telling me that there was 500 people in when there was 1,000 people, or two people when there was 200, that kind of thing. So I just got hold of a click counter, and I just tell them what it says on there to get the money. And that went on with The Who as well. So it was natural. So he started to become more orientated towards doing managerial things for Kit and Chris.
Yeah.
The real managers. Who didn't go to all the grubby places that we had to frequent.
So you were sort of tour manager before the term was invented, weren't you?
You would, if you like. So yeah. I didn't think either. I just thought it was something you needed to do, just like making sure they got there on time and the gear was working.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there were things that I was already doing in a way with the Walker Brothers, but the Walker Brothers were really only three guys you had to look after. They had a backing band, Johnny B. Great, which I think you reminded me of last time I spoke to you. And but it was more personal to John Scott and Gary than thing. But that's when I started lighting, which I then went on to do with The Who, because when you work in those circuits, then the Odeon circuit or Gaumont circuit, they're cinema theatres as well as anything else. But they only have footlights. They had very, very basic lighting. So I used to go up and get the projection to the projection room where they used to project the films from. But they would have other windows where they'd have limelights, the old limelights. And I used to go up there and get a pair of them, a mate and me, and we'd just work on Scott and John, because they were up front mainly, and managed to douse Gary, apart from any solos he'd do, with the existing lights that were there. So it was very minimal, but it was actually very dramatic, because I used to use blackout a lot of time with two pinpoint limelights on.
So were you sort of a self-taught lighting man then?
It's always been in my genes to like lighting.
Mm.
Lighting in houses, lighting around. Backlighting, bringing lighting out, because I used to be into photography,
mm-hmm.
and you need to position lights to get any kind of depth to things, which of course is an element of my career that went further on into holography and stuff. But the main thing is, you had a great talent, and I just wanted to make it shine a bit more. That's basically it, and having something else to do while they were on stage.
Right, well, I think I told you that prior to the interview, what I do is I put a thread on the Who forum inviting Who fans to ask you questions. So we're going to start on with the Who questions. The first one is from a guy called Oxmoon, good name. He says, where did you get the idea for the lasers on stage?
I was always interested in seeing lasers on BBC those programs where they show further developments and stuff. But the first time I saw a laser used was at Earl's Court on Zeppelin. And a friend of mine, we were working with a company in America for our early tours called Shoko. They owned that laser. And when I saw it come on, it was a very small one, but when I saw it come on, I said, that is going to be the future of what I'm going to be doing now. And basically, that's how I started using lasers. And having seen that, I went to get a more powerful one, because they had a Krypton laser, which was a nice red one, but it was only a 1 watt. With an argon laser, you could get 4 watts at that point in time from spectrophysics. Much more powerful thing. So that's why a lot of the lighting you saw was with green light. Argon has a spectrum on the green and blue light. And if you split them up with optical devices, you get the rainbow effects that I think I became well known for using.
Yeah.
Because I definitely went into... It's actually following on from the beams of light from a searchlight or blind spot. They're kind of like a solid shaft of light. And I like that structural form of light. And the laser gave me that ability to do it. And so I had to invest myself first, because nobody wanted to really invest in that cost at that time, because we didn't have a great deal of money. But I managed to score one from a friend who had a connection with a technical college in London, and we borrowed theirs. I paid them a few hundred quid, but they worked it out and we loaned it. And I took it up to a show at Leicester, I think it was Montfort Halls or something. Put it up. Everybody was kind of giving me the side glance with what's he up to now? What's he up to now? But when I manually let that laser go over the crowd, which had been raining, it was ideal situation, because with lasers you need atmosphere for them to pierce through so that they reflect the light and show the beams. And I'll never forget the first time that I exposed it I was doing it by hand, moving a card. I had a grating in front of the beam, it had a fan shape like this, and I moved the card across the beam, releasing them one at a time, buff, buff, uh-huh. buff, 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 and it caused the effect being a ceiling of light in that building, which was a low building, right across the audience. Mm. And Pete Towson went, he gave that fuck it. Like that, and dropped a chord. Oh. He kind of blew it, and I thought, well, I've either ruined the show or something. But they just loved it.
Yeah.
And then it was, had to buy a spare, just because you can't not have that effect in the show, especially on See Me, Feel Me and stuff like that.
I mean, the Who were known, for their classic 1970s stadium shows, the Who were known for those fantastic lasers. And, there's Roger standing like the iconic rock god that he is, surrounded by this laser light. And
it seemed to be successful, so I'm very thankful for the fact that I thought it up.
And then other bands hired your laser as well, because
Zeppelin came
McCartney and Wings did it for the Live and Let Die,
I did the Wings tour, and in that song, Live and Let Die was one of the things. Oh, loads of artists came through. I also did them for videos.
Yeah.
Kate Bush came. She was very up on the thing. I used to do all Kate Bush's lasers, and she became a firm friend. I couldn't count them all. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, because I by that time moved down to Shepperton Studios, the film, that's where the film line was. I started getting breaks and doing stuff for films. Mm. The first one being Alien, which was, for Ridley.
Yeah.
And he was just like gobsmacked. Oh. But I did have a problem with cameramen, because the light is not because it's coherent light, it's not like normal incandescent light. They weren't getting readings on their light meters, because it was difficult, because it's a coherent beam. And I used to try and tell very accomplished things, photographers and cinematographers, just trust me and film it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that even happened with the Rich, and I remember one famous photographer, cinematographer, who I can't remember his name at the moment, he said, I met him at Shepparton many years later, and he said, do you remember the first thing you do you know what you said to me when I was that chief cinematographer on that film? And I said, no. He said, don't bugger about asking me questions, just keep it rolling and print it, and then you'll see it.
Mm-hmm.
It was very funny the way he did it.
So John, your role in The Who eventually became a sort of kind of Mr. Fix-It kind of character, and you were sort of jack of all trades, and
it was anything that interested
me. Because Oxmoon, also one of his other questions he brings up about Woodstock.
Yes.
And
that was classic.
Can you tell us the story about you were the man who organised The Who getting their money paid, because there was
I was the only person that got the money paid.
Exactly. Because there was a bit of sort of altercation between the organisers and The Who about getting their money or something, wasn't there?
It wasn't an altercation. It was the fact that they said they couldn't pay. And I know that there's a lot of people had paid. And it was a deal. And I did a deal. And if I'd make a deal or on behalf of the band or whatever, that has to be kept to. Because we had done a tour. Pete at that particular time had a pregnant wife.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't want to come back on tour. And Pete and I had a dinner with Frank Barcelona and the organisers of Woodstock. And there was no Woodstock at that point in time. They were looking for a big act that would draw other acts to it so that they could build it up. It's the old game. And we liked the guys. The idea sounded good. And they made a promise they would pay. And I said, it won't be a lot, because I know you've got nothing at the moment. We'll see how it pans out. But it's $1,250... for me to take all our gear home for the tour we've got to do in England from the end of the tour we were doing, to bring it back here to do that show, because we've got to go back again and carry on with our European work. So it's not a lot of money, but it was more money in those days. But it was $12,500.
That was the actual fee, $12,500.
Yeah, and that was because I knew the price of the shipping. Plus there would be some airfares involved in that. And they made the promise. And Pete didn't like Woodstock. He was unhappy there because of the mud and the
whole ideology of it.
And with Karen being pregnant and so all that kind of stuff. So it was mayhem. I was getting really agitated at the fact that I got these vibes that they weren't going to pay us. And I thought that would be the end of, not the end of my career, but I take it very personally if someone breaks their word. And I know they had money, and they were just saying, "Well, the bank, the vault's locked with the money in it, and the bank guy's got the keys." So I said, "Get hold of the guy with the keys, get him down there, open it up, and bring me the money here, because otherwise we don't go on stage." And it was getting closer and closer, and it was one of those standoffs. Getting closer and closer to the time, and I said, "Well, we're not going on." He doesn't really want to go on anyway, so forget it. And they got really a bit nervous. Right, it was pushing it, but I think they'd moved out and got the money, because very suddenly it appeared behind me.
How that happens, isn't it?
behind me, a queue had formed, because they'd heard all the other managers. Clearwater's Revival was a lovely guy who managed them. And they just formed up a queue, and they said, "Well, where's ours?" And they went, "No, sorry, there's no money for you." And then, I'm sorry, I couldn't do their job for them. But it was funny.
Yeah,
It was a bit more stress at the time, but it made good history.
It did indeed.
It definitely put the Who as a band that was not to be just like messed around with when it came to money. Just learnt from that old clicker.
Exactly.
In the early days.
Exactly. Oxmoon also says, you were at the Shepparton Studios gig, Keith's last performance, as was I, May 1976, I think.
Yeah, whatever you say. It's a blur.
When Jeff Stein was filming for The Kids Are All Right, after that hash up the previous year at Kilburn.
Well, that's the famous film that they've still got on the road. I saw they were showing it at the show last night.
That's right, yeah.
Film of the lasers.
Have you got any good memories about that?
Good memories?
Any memories about that?
Well, it was a bit of a stress. I mean, they were in a smallish studio, and we had to run all this water. For personally, for the lasers and stuff, that was really my main concern, is to that kind of get as much light on there for him to pick up as possible. That was one of the cameramen I mentioned earlier, you know, who didn't think it was going to kind of read, as they term it. I'm sure there was a lot of stress in Spain, because there's always this with the Who, particularly in the earlier days. But I can't think of anything specific.
No. I mean, it was, I was there, and I was right down the front standing.
I saw you there. I tried to blind you with one of the lights.
I was sort of standing between John and Roger, and it was supposed to be just an hour's filming, and we'd all leave, and it ended up with them.
It became a gig.
It did a proper gig.
Yeah, why waste the opportunity of having a rehearsal?
Yeah.
I didn't mind, because I was rehearsing. If you look at those lousy cues I was doing on the lasers, because it was all done by hand. There was no computers in those days. So it was all done by hand, and I was watching it last night, and I sometimes look at that particular skip, and I go, oh my God, you missed that beat. You're not right on your... So yes, so we used it as we always do, though, used it as a chance to run through.
Yeah. Now, my personal Mr. Fix-It question I want to ask you is come from me. In the Quadrophenia box set that we did in 2011, Pete wrote the extensive liner notes, and he wrote this. I'm going to read a short paragraph. He said, "The most important leap in the making of Quadrophenia was during conversation with John Wolfe, who was our dedicated, technically driven, and totally insane production manager at the time. I explained to him that my studio down at Cleve would be fine for mixing, but that the recording was pretty basic. And he invited me to look at the Road Crew storage facility and tape archive in the old church hall in Thessaly Road, Battersea. And the conversation went like this. 'What a pity,' I said, 'that we don't have enough time to turn this building into a recording studio in time to record the tracks.' John Wolfe hardly batted an eyelid. 'When do you want it?' 'Sort of now,' I replied apologetically. 'Now,' repeated John. 'That'd be good,' I said. 6 weeks later, we moved in."
That was a force majeure.
And then he says something about, "You hired a troupe of 30 out-of-work circus performers build it.
They weren't out of work. They were between jobs. But they were a circus team from Australia, mainly from Australia. The best crowd you could ever do. They sang, did gymnastics, they built this thing on, they were carrying on in their shoulders. They did everything, these clowns. You know, they did acrobatics as well.
And
it
built
was
a recording
the fun,
studio.
They were just incredible. And they came in, they shifted around, they got on well together, they worked. You know, as Australia got its reputation for working without moaning, getting on with it. There wasn't a great deal of money. Didn't have much money. But what we tried to do is to have a very good time at it. And that produced a studio with very good vibes. No stresses apart from the normal thing of, like, putting up a building in a few weeks.
Yeah. But a building that 6 weeks after this conversation with Pete, they recorded one of the most iconic classic albums, not just in the Who's catalogue, but in rock history's catalogue.
It's the way it goes, Richard. Live at Leeds, much the same. The first live recording with a 16-track at a gig at a university with hardly any acoustic values to it, very resonance and stuff. That was a successful album. The studio was a successful project because it was done with love and spirit, and good vibes all round, and a need to do it. There was, when you've got a date to reach to have something done, you can pull it out. It's like pulling the soldiers off of Dunkirk. If it's got to be done,
it's got to be done.
We'll do it. That's it.
Right, let's have another question. Oxmoon has put so many questions in here, but they're all really good ones, so I'm going to include quite
a
few of them.
Hey? Where's he from, Oxmoon?
He's an American. I don't know what his other name is, but his tag is Oxmoon. Oh, he says, so who was the hardest to deal with out of the four? Moon, Entwistle, Daltrey, or Townsend?
Oh, all of them.
Yeah.
The hardest to deal with. No, you can't deal with anybody with the Who. But, no, Roger has... He's a vocalist. He could be difficult because his instrument is his throat. So the antics of the rest of them, when they would keep us up all night on tour, often left him a little bit grumpy. But he used to get us. He used to get his own backup from time to time. But I wouldn't say he was the hardest. I mean, Pete can be, you know, he's an artist. And he's a composer, and you know, it's a complex life. Could be a strain from time to time. But if you understand, when you understand what's happening around, and you stand back a little, give them some space, and they'll come out of it. You know, but you can't just keep pushing. As far as Keith is concerned, you could call him the most difficult, because wherever he went, it was like a hurricane he'd been through. You had to tidy up a lot of Holiday Inn payment bills for this, that and the other. But they were well renowned for
it.
So
you were the guy who was sweeping up after they'd left the hotel.
Oh, shit. No, that's what we did on one occasion is, it was, rather than clear up the damage, we changed all the numbers from one floor of the Holiday Inn to the floor below, and took all the numbers off upstairs, so that when the cleaners came along, they were blaming it somebody else for the mayhem, by which time we'd done a skit of the way, and they were left. The funny thing was, we left two of the management, Chris was one of them, not Kit, behind, because they couldn't get up. I tried to get everybody up. I said, we're going to hoof it now. And they went, but they didn't. The rest of the band understood what we were doing, obviously, because they'd created it. But we got out of there in our shooting break or whatever we had. And Chris and this other chap stayed behind because they were still asleep and they got arrested. And that the guy's name was Mr. Flaming. The manager was called Mr. Flaming.
Oh,
and as we drove around, I said, he's going to be flaming mad when he sees the state of his hotel. Yeah.
No, I actually said to you last night, John and I were at the O2 for the first of the two concerts to replace the postponed December ones. And I said to him that one of the Who fans called Richard, his question is just two words. He says, wildest party? And you told me the story about the Australian tour.
Well, it was actually New Zealand, but the Australian tour was a very up and down affair, with us mainly spending most of our time in jail, or our hotels being turned to jail. You know, we were under house arrest wherever we went because of an incident on an aeroplane I think it was Victoria or one of the states, where actually an Australian drank a stubby, which is a small beer, on a Sunday while flying over a territory which was a dry state. And we thought this was just... When she complained, the stewardess on the aeroplane complained to the chap, you shouldn't be doing that. Uproar went on the plane because we just couldn't understand the banality of it. So we had a very tense time from one place to another, from various things, and then we went to New Zealand with the Small Faces. You know, they're pretty volcanic as well. When we got to New Zealand, a lot of English people there, totally relaxed, and we had a party because I think the Small Faces had sold a more enormous number of records. Their record company gave Stevie Marriott a full record player. In those days, it wasn't tapes. It was a record player, speakers, and stuff like that. And after the show, one of the shows, we came back there, and Stevie Marriott, it started to flick. The arm on the record player started to click, and he decided that he didn't like this, so he stabbed his fist into it. And then it didn't work at all. We were all now well imbibed and were egging him on, because normally it's Keith that does that kind of stuff, but he was just an equivalent vocalist, Keith. He decided to take it out onto the balcony outside his bedroom window, and we all followed because we couldn't believe what he was about to do. He threw the whole stereo into the road, four stories down. But it was quite surreal, because it looked like those space things, when you see things tumbling in space,
yeah,
in that few seconds that they were rotating majestically until they smashed to pieces on the sidewalk, and some people just walked by and went, behind them. And it kind of erupted in the thing, so there was furniture being broken, there was all this, that, and the other. And they said,
well, more stuff followed out the window.
No, not yet. But yeah, they said, that was fantastic. Stevie Marriott went, did you see that, Mac? And he said, yeah, that was great, wasn't it? So I had my dressing gown on because I joined this party halfway through. And so I decided to go downstairs, pick it up all off the street, take it all upstairs again, and give it to Stevie again, and they threw it out the window again with the furniture.
So where was Keith at the party?
Keith was incredible, because I think he was learning some tips. If he didn't know anything about the destruction, he'd learnt something from the Small Faces.
Yeah.
We were very, very tight. The two bands were very tight. It was a great bill.
Next question. Again, it's one of Oxmoon's. He says, is it true that most of the tours only made money the last few weeks after you'd paid all the bills?
If they made any money at all, it was always towards the end. Mm. Yeah. Mainly the only money we had was any deposits that the people had given to Premier Talent, our agency, because we couldn't have got hold of it. But we didn't have too much of that. We mainly picked up cash. But yeah, no, there was a lot of wastage. It was necessary. It's called entertaining.
He says, Bomber says, hi, old Wiggy. He says, have you heard about the application of holosonic audio spotlights or sound travelling in lasers?
Yes, I've heard of it, but I haven't had come
He says,
it.
Do you think it's practical for a gig?
No. No, I mean, it's not practical right now, that's for sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I've got a question from Arnie, who says to me, well, you must have been around working with The Who when Pete was proposing Lifehouse.
Certainly was. It was a big part of his yearning to get a whole concept together for an album. And it was entitled Lifehouse, and it was very intense. I didn't get involved because I don't do, it wasn't my part to be anything part of what his thinking was on it. But I used to go over to his studios while he was recording it, and there were some fantastic songs on there to this day.
Did you understand his concept when it was explained to you?
I vaguely remember it. I did understand it then, but it was basically about families moving and living in a different style of living. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, they asked a friend of mine, Cy Langston, who you know, to take Ethan Russell out to do a front cover, a potential front cover for Lifehouse. Mm-hmm. And because the Lifehouse were, involved shifting family where people were living and where they were moving to, it was they wanted to get a desolate looking shot with a vehicle that would be moving them. So we hired a Range Rover. And we tried to find, and the spec was, find an area of outstanding beauty without any trees. And that's impossible in England, virtually, in the south of England, to find. And so we drove for hours making up this, and this was the singular phrase. We haven't found an area of outstanding beauty without any trees, because there isn't an area of outstanding beauty. We finally did find something on the South Downs, where Ethan did a shot, and basically the horizon was the cliffs. You don't see the sea, but it looks as though it would carry on forever. Mm. And that was a proof I saw, and I don't know where it is now. It is one. I understand that a lot of those shots that Ethan did got lost somewhere along the line. But it was quite a shoot.
Yeah, that's an extraordinary story. I never knew that a cover concept had ever been dreamed up
I'm either making it up, yeah. But believe me, if you ask Pete, he would have seen it because I think Ethan took some of the shots back to him.
Yeah. Of course, Ethan took the cover photograph that we all know of Who's Next with them.
Well, Who's Next? You know about the story to Who's Next.
Go on.
Well, we were up north, we were touring up north, and on the way up there, once again, Ethan was with us. He didn't have a license, so we spent a lot of time together. And as we went up for some of the more mundane gigs, we noticed. I'd like to say I noticed, but I because I made the comment. Oh, look, that there looks like one of the blocks in 2001, Space Oddity. But instead of it being that shiny black monolith that circulates around the film. These were just ugly concrete towers that were actually placed to stop slippage. So they pour slurry out of the mines onto them, but so they wouldn't cause another Abba van, if you remember that. they were held back by these big concrete blocks, which looked like blocks of flats, but they were very big. And when we'd done a few gigs and we were talking about areas of outstanding beauty without any trees and laughing and joking, we drove back past that back from a gig on the same road. I said, let's stop off here. I fancy a leak anyway. And let's have, you know, because the whole band was going in tandem. And so we all got out and started to peeing up against it. And that's what those little shadows are. Yeah. You do know that, don't you?
Well, yeah. I think Ethan tells the story that when it came to actually do the shot, that they'd all had pees anyway, and nobody could actually have a pee for the shot.
That's not entirely true. Oh, okay. Well, one of them was weird, but mine might have been round the other side, being shy and not wanting to expose myself to the average eyes of the band. I could have been around the back, but no, there was some peeing done.
Oh, right, because the myth was always you had to pour water or something.
Yeah, well, I think he poured it in a very perfect way of a beer.
Yeah.
I think it was Roger, because he's stepping away from it, whistling. If you look at him, he's actually doing what you do with a Jimmy Riddle, and that is putting up the flies and
doing flies and whistling.
I don't think he was acting that, but you know. My memory may be a little bit more colourful than Ethan's.
Actually, it's great to hear you tell it, because, I mean, there are so many stories that go around about the Who's Next cover and exactly where it was.
I was emailed a few months ago about it. You know, how did that come about?
And people saying it's a support for a motorway bridge and it's this and this.
No,
that.
It was to keep slag.
I think they played at Sunderland, or something like that.
It will be somewhere dark and deep.
Great story. Very grey. You saying
But you see, that's the thing about the studios coming together, Live at Leeds coming together, great shots coming together. They're just all luck. They're all part of timing and the spirits. And if the luck's in your direction, you take it.
Creative spontaneity.
Yeah.
Talking of which, creative spontaneity. The Rolling Stones Rock and Roll Circus of 1968. Yeah, I know you're there.
1968. I was there with one of the last things I used to wear the wig on. Mm. Probably running from the bill, because the wig was very good for that. Because if they recognised you with one hairstyle, you could get another wig on and be another person altogether.
It was a kind of sort of Beatle wig that you had, wasn't it?
It was. Yeah, it had to be a Beatles wig. Yeah, it had to be emulated. And I got this kind of nose which looked very much like John Lennon, so I used to pose around in the Bentley and get screamed at as well, so I loved all that posing.
So tell us about the Who at the Rock and Roll Circus. They did a quick one, which they did
they
last night.
They did a
night,
quick one, which was the first time, I think, and maybe the only time it got recorded, isn't it?
Yeah.
It was a fun day, as much as you could. The producer, I can't remember the director, was it...
Lindsay Hogg.
They were all, it was a great time, and it was nice for us to be with the Stones, because the Stones, kind of emulate and look up to Stones. The Beatles were the pair that the Who were following up the ladder of being the top three. And we all had to wear ridiculous cloaks, and I think there were some funny hats involved,
They were sort of like bishop's mitres. Sort of,
they were more like gnomes wear, you know, those conical caps.
Yeah.
They were all made out of felt, all run up very quickly by someone at the back. And we were there a long time. That's the first time I got in tune with filming. Takes a very long time to do. Because they were stopping and starting. But it was great fun. I mean, we had great fun doing it.
And who were the best act? That's what they say.
Well, we did play live, and the Who have always pulled it out live.
Mm.
I mean, you saw it the other night. You know, they just managed to be spontaneous and immediately swing into it, very much like the time when you mentioned earlier that we turned the filming of The Kids All Right into a show.
A gig. Yeah.
When I was doing the lasers on it. And the same thing happened at the circus. You know, the band just like took it on and played it as if they were playing a gig.
Mm.
And so, of course, they had routine. We'd been working every gig in the book. They were like kind of expert at it. Whereas maybe some of the other people weren't, and so it turned out to be the highlight of a live performance, because I think that Lindsay just managed to do it in one shoot. I mean, because it went from one end to the other, apart from breaking it down into songs, which is what very often happens.
That's
just to the best of my memory, but you know, you're talking about a long time ago and the air was infused with certain substances
to
a very high degree.
Jazz cigarettes were consumed, were
they?
I think I'm going to wrap this up by asking you to relate this delightful story, which you just told me before we started this interview, that is Who-related, because it ends on a Who note, but it involves the recording of the Beatles' All You Need Is Love, the live broadcast.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that was one of the highlights of my memories of those times, because it was again much the same times in the late 60s. We were asked to be part of an audience, really, the band, you know, the Who. I don't remember Pete being there, but certainly John and Keith and I were there, because I drove them there. And so to fill out the crowd, by then we'd started to know the Beatles. Personally, and so we were part of the crowd that had gathered. And in fact, I have the dubious I wouldn't say it, an accolade of being the last person on that video moving across the stage in a hat with the wig poking out from underneath and the nose. And if ever I see it, I see it fading away, and I'll obviously just go back to that magic time, because that came together very, very well, and became quite a good song, I hear.
It did all right for them.
Well, I think it was us that helped.
And subsequently from that, you were in the Speakeasy, was it, with Keith?
The Scotchers and James? Before that I met Keith. By that time, we were, you know, I was working with them, because that's why John, Keith and I were down there, because I'd driven them there. Prior to that, or maybe shortly afterwards, I was sitting with Keith and we were just having our drinks and stuff. And
you had your wig on.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I had the Irish on.
Yeah.
I was probably running from the law again. And John came down. He came down with the Beatles after an Abbey Road session of something. And I was in deep conversation. I think it was Keith. It might have been Paul McCartney there as well. Mm. I think Ringo was in the corner. It was actually one of those conversations where Keith said, I want to join your band. And he said, Paul said to him, that's very nice, John, but we've got a drummer. And he's sitting over there. and he said, yeah, no, but I'm a better drummer than he is. And so I said, well, Bingo was like, it was very great. It's very, very funny. Keith and Ringo are the funniest double act, in the world. And he said, oh, that's all right then, Keith. That'll be all right. That's all right. John Lennon then turns up, because he's come down later on. I don't think George was with him. He got to the bottom of the stairs, and we were in full flow, and I've got my Beatle wig on, and he kind of grabbed hold of the stairs and said, "Well, Christ, I thought I was dead. I looked over at you, and I thought I was looking at myself at an out-of-body experience." Because it looked so much the same. And we formed a nice little relationship out of that.
Yeah.
We went over to his house a few times.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, what you really were getting at as being a funny moment in time. Yeah.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Fond memories.
Indeed, indeed, indeed. And we could go on for hours. But
yes, you could. I'll come back.
I've got to wrap it up now, I think. Because
yes, why don't you wrap it up? I've only got like 55 minutes left on the meeting now.
Right. John, thanks ever so much.
And, no, it's been a pleasure. I'm sorry I mumble a lot. And
well,
the senior moments do come more often than not these days.
John, thanks ever so much.
Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Sad man behind blue eyes.